Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. On October 27, 2018, a man entered a synagogue in Pittsburgh and began shooting. In the end, 11 people were killed in a massacre officials have said was a hate crime. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette was there to report on the attack, its aftermath, and its impact on the community. Lillian Thomas, assistant managing editor at the Post-Gazette, and Rich Lord, an investigative reporter, were part of the team that earned a Pulitzer Prize for this year for that coverage. Lillian Thomas and Rich Lord, thank you both for coming in to talk with us.
Thank you for having us.
Appreciate it, Ann.
The attack took place at the Tree of Life Synagogue on a Saturday morning during worship services, and along with killing 11 people, 7 people were wounded, including the police officers, and it's been called the deadliest attack on Jews in the United States history. Lillian, can you walk us through what was that like for you and your team when this is happening on a Saturday morning, you find out about it, and you know you need to be there and start covering it?
Sure. I was at my dining room table, and my daughter was visiting from out of town, and we were busy planning a Target run. And I saw an alert on my phone that said the address of the synagogue, which I was familiar with because it's in a neighborhood pretty close to where I live, and that there was an active shooter. And I pretty much knew the Target run was off, so I woke up my police reporter, who was sleeping in that day, and called the desk, and they had also heard it. They'd already sent photographers and got reporters moving toward the scene. So by the time I got to the office, Rich had already beat me there because everybody, through alerts or through phone calls or through social media, had heard about it. We already had a team working and people out in the field. It was difficult to get accurate information right away. Obviously, the police were there, and when they first got to the scene, they were being fired upon. And when SWAT went in, they took fire, too. So it was a chaotic, confusing scene. And in the office, I was just trying to deploy as many people as I could, but also keeping people like Rich focused on trying to get more information about the shooter, because he was pretty quickly identified. It was the attack started just before 10, and everything was over about a quarter after 11. So it happened very, very quickly.
You had that coverage that was kind of minute by minute using social media and letting people know what was going on, but then you also had that kind of bigger picture coverage. Rich, what was it like for you? Tell us what you were working on.
Yeah, I came in as soon as I heard on NPR, actually, that the shooting, that there was a multiple casualty shooting going on in Squirrel Hill. And my first job was to try to verify the name of the shooter, which we were able to do through some sources. And then that kind of ended up guiding the rest of my next couple of weeks. My job was to figure out whatever I could about the accused shooter, Robert Bowers, and to get as deep into him as I could. But I remember driving in, and when I left home, the count was 3. And when I got to the office, they were saying 7. And it just kept rising, and I remember just thinking, "Oh my gosh, it's my town's turn now. This has come to us." And I remember how chilling that was. And then when I got in there, fortunately, the atmosphere of kind of professionalism, get the story, get the facts, get it right, get it out there, was really prevalent throughout the newsroom, and that had a real, I think, a calming effect on everyone. The professionalism which the staff showed, obviously, in the toughest story you can cover.
Right, because it is your community, and I can't imagine how difficult it must be. On the one hand, you do want to make sure you're getting the coverage and letting people know what's going on, but on the other hand, it's something so horrible. And just because you're a reporter and editor doesn't mean you're not affected by it. How did you kind of maintain that professionalism that you were talking about?
I think I just watched, frankly, some of my colleagues and tried to imitate them, but my job quickly became I was separate from the team that really had to spend a lot of time with the survivors' families and very emotionally sensitive work there. And I ended up just being really tunnel vision focused on understanding the shooter. And so I guess the just plain step-by-step process you have to go through to try to get there kept the emotions at bay for a pretty long time, although they did come out at times.
Yeah, I imagine.
I would echo that. We were so busy and just focused on task after task and thinking about what we needed to do now and what we needed to do for we knew things were coming up. We knew the funerals would be coming up. We knew more information about the shooter would come up. So it was constantly doing and thinking ahead. But as Rich said, things would break through. For me, the moment was on Sunday morning when they announced the names of the victims. The medical examiner's office came out with the names. And one of the names was Jerry Rabinowitz, who was a doctor who was our family physician for many, many years. And my first thought was, well, maybe there's another Jerry Rabinowitz. It was just that wanting to deny it for a minute, but pretty quickly I knew it was. I knew he was a very religious man, and I knew that he worshipped in Squirrel Hill. So that was something that stopped everything for just a minute. But then we had a team of reporters who were just waiting in a coffee shop in Squirrel Hill to fan out and get the information about the victims once we had their names. So that was a momentary thing and then went along.
The Pulitzer organization says the Post-Gazette was chosen, quote, for immersive, compassionate coverage of the massacre at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue that captured the anguish and resilience of a community thrust into grief. How did you balance that coverage, reporting what's happening, getting the information out there, but at the same time, reflecting your community, not being seen as cold and impersonal?
I think our relationships in the community, the fact that I think the Post-Gazette is trusted in the community helped. I think that people also recognized that this was us, that we as journalists were part of the same community. And we were very, very conscious of the fact, because we did have people who were involved, of how difficult this was. Also, the community itself was just kind of immediately, there was a vigil organized by students at Alderdice High School, which is in Squirrel Hill, the same night. And that was just kind of mind-blowing to me, that people so quickly stood up and started organizing. I think that also the Post-Gazette just kind of became a little bit of a town hall. People felt like they could come to us for information and that we were out in the community. It really was an extraordinary experience. I think just being local journalist who knew the area well helped us get through that very difficult balance between covering and being part of the community.
Right, yeah. Rich, any other thoughts on that for you, what it was like?
Yeah, the entire national media had descended on our city, and so we would come to a door, and as we pulled up, ABC would be leaving the door. And if the door didn't open for us, then the New York Times would show up right after us. And there was this constant stream of reporters. And at times that really made it very difficult, because a lot of kind of fatigue set in the community. But other times, being the Post-Gazette guy, being the local guy, got you the door open, knowing the neighborhood, knowing somebody who knew somebody who went to the same school, got you in the door when the big guys, the big national guys, could not.
You are recognized for your coverage of the shooting and its immediate aftermath, but the stories and web features also included a lot of follow-up, which, Rich, you were involved with some of this, including profiles of the victims. How did you decide what was the best way to allocate your resources? Because it's a newspaper, you don't have unlimited resources. How did you decide on that?
We really started thinking about that the first day, knowing we knew that we would get the victims' names and that we needed to do something to pay tribute to the victims. And so we started thinking about a special section. And our managing editor at the time helped us come up with the idea that we were going to do a special section in a week, and that we could go full tilt on the breaking, but at the same time always be conscious that we could save some stuff, that some of the reporting that didn't fit would be held forward for the special section. So it was a balancing act, but I always had in the back of my head what we were going to do, and we decided on a plan pretty early, so that helped guide us.
Were there any particular stories or people that you spoke with that stood out to you? And when you think about it a year from it happening, that really stand out in your memory?
From the perspective of trying to understand the accused shooter, Robert Bowers, I had a team of of three people working with me, Liz Navratil, Chris Huffaker, and Mike Fuoco. And we spent a lot of time chasing every lead we could possibly come up with to try to understand this guy, who at the time no one wanted to be associated with, of course. So it was a tough road. But then finally, you know, I ended up in the backyard of a guy who knew him well enough that his kids called Robert Bauer's Uncle Babs. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is finally a doorway into this guy's just personal progression as a human being and ideological progression. And I'll never forget sitting in there doing that interview with this guy who just knew him, was his best friend for a decade. Finally, we had a breakthrough where we felt we had a little bit of an insight into who this guy was as a person. You don't forget those interviews.
How about you, Lillian? Is there any moments or people that you spoke with or that were featured that stood out for you?
I think a couple of things stood out related to Robert Bauer's, which was the paramedics and the doctors at the hospital where he was treated because he was injured in the shooting, the exchange of gunfire with police. The paramedics talked about him having just a sort of sick smile on his face when they first brought him out. And there was a nurse and the president of the hospital who were both Jewish. And they talked about the fact that they were treating this person even as they knew that he was an anti-Semite who had gunned down 11 people or killed 11 people. And the power of those people following their medical mission, despite what they were witnessing, just was very striking.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Rich, you were just talking a little bit about the coverage you did, and you were really trying to talk to his former coworkers, anybody who knew him. Can you just kind of walk us through a little bit about what you found out about him?
Sure. We started out knowing almost nothing other than what was on his social media feed. Of course, that's your standard first step nowadays. And his social media feed certainly showed this very toxic mix of anti-Semitism and anti-immigrant rhetoric. And we understood from, you know, the first hour what the motivation for this attack, the kind of twisted motivation was. It was his belief that the congregation he was attacking was involved with bringing refugees into the country, and that combination of a Jewish congregation involved with refugee resettlement was what drew the target on the back that he eventually, of course, fired upon. So we started there, and we quickly learned, actually through a tip, that he had been associated with a fairly right-wing talk radio show in the 1990s. So we started working the kind of back alleys of the internet to verify his association with this radio show. We started trying to reach out to the folks involved with that show to see how deep and personal that association went. Meanwhile, we were attempting to track down information on his family. Of course, we learned that his father had killed himself in 1979 while he was facing attempted rape charges, and that attempted rape happened to have happened in Squirrel Hill, the same neighborhood, of course, in which the shooting occurred. So we began going through a process in court to pry open those records. They were, in our view, illegally sealed, and we got them unsealed. Meanwhile, we were chasing other records from all around the country to try to verify different associations and different family relationships. We were hitting the doors of family members, of course, who did not want to be associated with him and were largely unhelpful. And then the key was sending public records requests to all the municipalities he'd lived in and saying, okay, we need you to search your archives for any interaction Robert Bauer's may have had with your municipality during X period of time. That's what got us a police report, which led us to his friends who worked at a bakery with him back in the day. And that opened up a lot more of insight on who this person was, because obviously the act is monstrous. But our job, I think, part of our job is to try to tell our community, you know, what could this person have been conceivably thinking? And that we took that very seriously.
That kind of starts to answer my next question, which is that sometimes with these people, there's discussion about how much coverage, how much attention should you give them? Should you even use their name on television? This is a newspaper, obviously it's a little different, but I just wonder what that discussion was like at the Post-Gazette for you. Did you discuss how much attention you wanted to give him while at the same time getting some insight into what was going on?
We talked about that a lot. We wanted to be sure that the victims were front and center. And as I said, when the victims' names came out, we did a special section on them. But we also knew from day one, we have to understand who this is and what he did. And that's why Rich and team were deployed, to just focus on him. We did do a little bit of frameworking in terms of when we were doing stories focused on the victims, we would not use the shooter's name high in the story. When we were doing stories about Robert Bowers, obviously we're going to name him. We were not going to not name him. But we did think about that in terms of visuals as well, that we were going to focus again on the victims, the community showing its resilience while telling people who this was and how it happened.
So you've been doing a lot of reporting on the social media role in this and other incidents like this and white supremacist networks. I think I read a couple stories from you, Rich, about that. And it seems like this is going on in the United States, is going on in other countries. Authorities know it's happening, but when it comes to figuring out how to address it, that's a different question. I think there was one story from you, and it had information from a report from the Anti-Defamation League. What are you hearing when you're reading these reports and talking to people about it, about possible ways to address the situation, what's happening on all these social media networks?
It's a couple different approaches that are out there. We'll have a forthcoming story about efforts to use technology to kind of tone down the vitriol that you have online right now. There's a number of techniques, tools emerging from everywhere, from Carnegie Mellon University to Google's offices in California, that aim to just kind of redirect some of the hate that's going on there, or just plain lower the volume. Of course, a lot of the social media companies are trying to, say, ban or quarantine people who violate certain, you know, terms of service that they establish. I'm a little pessimistic about the effectiveness of that, because, you know, folks will simply move off to Gab or 8chan, which have really no standards of, you know, very loose standards of, I guess, discourse. And they might find themselves in even more of an echo chamber on those social media platforms than they would if they were still moving on Facebook and Twitter, for instance, or some of the bigger platforms. Of course, there are folks who have left the white nationalist movement who now specialize in attempting to kind of bring people back. I'm not 100% sure that there's enough folks in that role, frankly, to deal with the proliferation of anger on that you particularly see online.
So people who were white nationalists but now are no longer and are trying to reach out to people and say, you don't need to be this way and this is why.
Kind of like, you know, the classic gang member who left the fold and now works the streets trying to convince guys to go right. You know, there's a community of folks who do that sort of on the far fringes, who try to kind of bring people back. And I don't know, maybe there's a combination of these techniques that will make a difference. But the roots of this problem are pretty deep, and it's difficult to see an easy fix for any of the hate we're seeing online.
If you're just joining us, I'm Ann Danahy. This is Take Note on WPSU. We're talking with Lillian Thomas, an assistant managing editor at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Rich Lord, an investigative reporter there. They were part of the team to report on the October 2018 mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, its aftermath, and its impact on the community. The team earned a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage. So the Post-Gazette did win the Pulitzer, and you received this $15,000 award, and the newspaper donated that, gave that to the Tree of Life to help rebuild the synagogue. Can you talk a little bit about how you felt about receiving the Pulitzer, what that was like, and then how you decided to give the award?
It was an humbling experience. We were proud of our work, but it's also just kind of confusing in a way to be awarded something that means a great deal for something that was so traumatic and tragic. It just feels like celebrating is not what you want to do. And I think that donating the money was just one tiny gesture in trying to say to the community, this wasn't about us. This was about our part in the community, and we did what we think is good work, but we were doing it because that's what we do as journalists. And that decision was something that I don't know what else we could have possibly done with the money. So I was glad we did that.
Federal prosecutors are seeking the death penalty in this case. There's been some opposition to that, and it's been reported that some members of the congregations that worshiped at Tree of Life don't want the death penalty pursued, and there have been reports of different reasons. Some people want to have closure, and there's always concern if you're pursuing the death penalty that can drag things out longer. And then there's also people who are philosophically opposed to the death penalty. And I wondered from your point of view as reporters who are there in the community, what do you see the community response as being like?
You are correct that people have different opinions. Our religion reporter, Peter Smith, has talked to people in other shootings and mass shootings, and some who did go through trials have spoken to the survivors here about how traumatic it is. And I think that did have an impact on some, just to understand that the trial will probably be excruciating. And as you said, for some, it is very much philosophical. What I do see is that the congregations, the three congregations that all worshiped in Tree of Life, are supportive of one another. It's that they, I don't mean they're all in agreement, but the ones who might want the death penalty are not at cross purposes or trying to undermine those who say we don't want it.
Lillian, what is it like for you now to continue to have your team covering this story in different ways? It's one thing when it's just unfolding and there's the initial stories. I mean, it's something that's difficult to cover right away, even while it's happening, but then to be covering it a year later, 2 years later.
As many news organizations do, we are looking back for the one-year anniversary, so we've been doing a lot of deep reporting and talking to people again, and also trying to figure out how this goes looking forward. The experience was clearly a traumatic one for the city, very, very traumatic. But I think that what impressed members of the community here and elsewhere was the resilience and the immediate determination to stand up. This sign was developed very quickly, which had something that looked a little bit like the Steelers logo, but said stronger than hate. And those signs are still up all over the city. Peter Smith, again, our religion reporter, I was talking to him before we came, and he said, just remember that despite the fact that there's still huge amounts of anti-Semitism and a growing sense of this hate on the internet, that this is still a place where the police ran into that building and took fire and ran back in, whereas in many countries in Europe, the police stood by while atrocities happened. So there's a little bit of hopefulness there in the very community-wide ecumenical response. The many Christian churches in Pittsburgh have hosted, they hosted the vigils. They have hosted members of the three congregations at Tree of Life who are now worshiping elsewhere. Calvary Episcopal Church hosted them during the high holidays. And Peter just described to me that they covered all the crucifixes so that this would be a place that for this period of time, for the high holidays, that would be a place that the congregation could be comfortable in. So that a year after looking at that response is a little hopeful, but talking to Rich and thinking about the terrible spread of hate makes you feel the other way.
Is that something, Rich, that you're getting even more of a sense of as you do this reporting and this investigative reporting, and you're seeing this is not just one person kind of opening up this window onto a way of life?
Yeah, unfortunately, my beat now includes hate, and I do have to interact with folks on the extreme and violent fringe to some extent, and that's depressing. I often find myself wondering, why is all of this hatred out there? Why is it so easy to provoke this kind of anger in our society? And when we're still a very affluent, very well-off society, it also hits pretty hard as a parent of two teenagers, realizing that my guys are going to grow to adulthood in a society in which there's just this really deep division that I never felt growing up.
So the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette was recognized for the incredible reporting. while things were happening and in the longer range. But it is a difficult time for newspapers in general, and it just makes you realize that without newspapers, who would be doing that type of coverage of those incidents or even other types of things that are going on in our communities? Is that a concern at all as we see all the changes that are happening? The Post-Gazette is moving to at least a part-time online newspaper. Are there concerns about what types of coverage you'll be able to continue to do?
I think news organizations all over the country are facing this difficult time. We have cut back to just 3 print days, but I would also say that our online presence is extremely vigorous. When I talk to young reporters and interns, I always say that I am pessimistic in the short run because this news industry has not figured out how to make money, but I'm very optimistic in the long run because there has never been more interest in the news, and I just think that there's fantastic work being done all over the country by news organizations, large and small. So I just keep telling the interns they have to figure out how to make money because I do believe that this industry is not going anywhere. There's just too much appetite for this information.
Rich, will you tell the young people who are considering becoming reporters about what they need to do to prepare for the industry?
If you come to the Post-Gazette, it's a newspaper with a tradition of supporting deeper reporting and a newspaper guild, which is also dedicated to maintaining the capacity of that newspaper to do the deeper stuff. I don't think you can get the depth of response, the depth of emotion in any other media that we saw in the weeks following Tree of Life, when our editor at the time, David Shribman, put the Hebrew characters for the opening portion of the Kaddish, the prayer of mourning, on the front page on the Friday following the shooting. The reaction was amazing. Global reaction, global emotional, deep reaction to just the sight of an American newspaper, the front page of an American newspaper with the opening characters of the prayer of mourning on the front page. I don't know how you do that anywhere else.
Rich Lord and Lillian Thomas, thank you both very much for coming in to talk with us.
Thank you.
Been a pleasure, Anne.
We've been talking with Lillian Thomas, assistant managing editor at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Rich Lord, an investigative reporter there. Thomas and Lord were part of the team that earned a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of the October 2018 shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue that left 11 people dead. To hear this and other episodes of Take Note, go to wpsu.org/take note. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.